Welcome to episode 11 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse, in which four friends and Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 to 3 before the season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Before we launch into the discussion of episodes 11 and 12 of the second season, let's go around and introduce ourselves.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Chip Sutterth.
And I am Katie Burt.
Warren Fry, where is Warren? What is with Warren?
Oh.
What? Yeah, when is Warren? Where is Warren?
Why is Warren?
Warren is a very busy media person. I feel like he's always doing something media related when he's not here.
So it's just us, and we're on the verge of finishing up season 2. This is just blazing by really fast.
I know.
Yeah, we're almost there. What did everyone think of these 2 episodes?
I will have some really, really shouty words to say about Aaron Wright, which I shouted in spoiler space before. I liked both of these quite a bit, especially The Monster and the Rocket. And I just feel like lots of stuff is finally happening. And oh my God, the Bobby thread.
They're both so good. When you were saying, especially Monster and the Rocket, and then I was like, yeah. But then also, the other, Here There Be Dragons is also so good. These are such strong episodes.
Yeah, it's competitive. When we finished rewatching these episodes, I think I said to Jen about The Monster and the Rocket that this is my favorite episode of The Expanse, which we'll have to see if that's true as we keep moving forward, but I do love it so much. It feels in general like these 2 episodes are the payoff for a lot of long storylines, a lot of character development that's been happening since the very beginning of season 1. And that just feels so good. That's like what serialized storytelling should be. So I'm glad we're here and we're watching this show fire in all cylinders again. But before we dive into a little bit more specific discussion, let's go over what happened in these episodes. Here are our clever episode synopses.
So first we have Here There Be Dragons, which aired on April 5th, 2017. Now that she's seen the ocean, Bobby has precisely zero time for the political runaround she's been getting when she's asked about what happened to her team. She punches Captain Martins until he reveals Ganymede was a test of the protomolecule, and that the protomolecule men are for sale as a weapon to the highest bidder. Bobby then steals Martin's iPad with the protomolecule commercial that Mao has on it and makes for the safety of Amnesty on Earth, bringing the information to Christian. Christian was hoping she'd be less dramatic about it, but she should have been more specific. Meanwhile, Christian has put the financial squeeze on the most distant of Jules Pierre Mao's relatives, including his cousin who's a monk. If you met the guy, your bank account is probably frozen. It forces Mao out of hiding. He invites Christian to a space meeting where Kotiar thinks it's a trap, but Christian has already RSVP'd before she asked his opinion, so picks out a perfect outfit. In a flashback, we get to know more about Dr. Strickland, the Expanse's latest evil mad scientist character. This time, in a totally different mad scientist character, excited about experimenting on children. We see him leading May, Prax's daughter, through the station during the Ganymede incident. She's not super into it, but he distracts her with plant games. In the regular timeline, the Rossi crew makes their way across a dying Ganymede station on the search for May, if you're Prax, the protomolecule, if you're Holden, and General Salvation, if you're Naomi. They find a gaggle of Strickland's mad scientist friends eating pizza, taking them out with their own grenade, and inadvertently release a protomolecule man in the process. Is May or one of the other kids Strickland has been experimenting on the protomolecule man? We don't know yet. Meanwhile, Alex spends most of the episode talking to himself and the Rossi, and then slingshots around some moons, but eventually makes it to Ganymede, undetected, to offer his friends a ride. Naomi and Amos decline, with plans to head back to the Weeping Synabulous to help as many people as they can get off the station. But Holden and Prax accept. They're interested in finding the proto-molecule man, but for different reasons.
Then we get to The Monster in the Rocket, which was April 12th, 2017. So Aaron Wright seems like he's at the end of the line. He looks mournful. He looks like Ross from Friends, for God's sake. He cuts himself shaving, very thematic blood, and he earnestly tells his son to, you know, just listen to his heart, that sort of thing. Avasarala tells him that she's got a meeting with Mal, and he suggests Avasarala make a peace offer to Jules-Pierre Mal so that Earth will at least have access to the proto-molecule rather than just leaving it to Mars. And then he writes a letter to his ex and looks at a vial of poison, and this just looks like it wraps it all up for Aaron Wright. But wait! Instead, he poisons the Martian defense minister, untraceable, of course, so Aaron Wright isn't repentant. He's just a jerk. Meanwhile, Avasarala, Kachar, and Draper, she's a not-quite-unwilling new bodyguard, fly up to Mal's ship. The meeting's going great. Mal looks like he's ready to cut a deal, and then, whoops, Aaron Wright's on the phone. He's blown up the Mars ship going to Ganymede to extract Mal's scientists. And now that Mal's out of support, Aaron Wright orders him to kill Christian and get back to work for Earth. Repeat, Aaron Wright's an unrepentant jerk. Speaking of Ganymede, the death cascade is underway. Naomi repairs the weeping somnambulist, but it's only got enough air for half of the 100 desperate belters outside the ship. Her morality trumps her self-preservation, and she and a big guy organize the refugees by age. And when they get to the 51st refugee, Naomi tries to stay behind, but the big guy won't let her. Some have sacrificed themselves that others might live. And finally, James Ahab Holden, Prax Plant Guy Ming, and Alex, I have a last name, Kamal, have been hunting the protomolecule hybrid in the Rossi. James is increasingly shouty and Ahab-y as they fly where ship was not meant to fly while evading detection. Every time they try to shoot it, the plant guy wants to talk to it, and then the somnambulist makes contact with the MCRN, who orders them back down to Ganymede or they'll blow them up. So, pleas for mercy falling on deaf ears, the Martians launch a torpedo, and the Rossi rides to the rescue, giving Holden an actual goddamn hero speech moment.
This is the warship Rocinante. You're aware of our capabilities more than anyone. We're escorting a vessel of refugees away from your AO. Any ship that opens fire on us will feel the sum total of our state-of-the-art Martian arsenal rammed up its ass. We'll all die together. This is our only and final warning. Stay clear.
Which is great and all, but the proto-molecule hybrid has hitched a ride on the Rossi, and I think they just might have to deal with it next episode.
So a lot happens in these episodes. I feel like that's true every episode, but as we get closer to the season end, things are really speeding up. Both of these episodes were directed by Robert Lieberman, who's another kind of just prolific TV director who's done a lot of different series that film in Canada that you probably recognize and have watched. He also directed two episodes in season one and has yet to direct any more episodes of The Expanse. Amongst his filmography, he has D3, The Mighty Ducks, which for me felt like a standout that I needed to include.
Oh yeah.
Were there any visual and or directorial moments in these episodes that really stood out to you guys? Any kind of storytelling moments that maybe weren't specific to the script or that were made even better by the direction?
It all moved really well. It didn't seem particularly Mighty Ducky. But between the CGI scenes, everything else seemed fairly, I don't want to say pedestrian, not anything like that, but it seems pretty straightforward to me.
It feels competent.
Yeah.
In a way that's like, nothing stood out to me, but it not in a good way or a bad way. It just was like, oh, this was just competent.
Yeah, which makes sense with his background.
Yeah, you get a few like forced perspective shots, like when Aaron Wright's holding up the poison and it's in foreground in focus and he's a little fuzzy in the background. You know, standard stuff like that. You don't have any stupid shots like, hi, I'm a brand new director trying to do a funky angle that nobody's done before. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a pro about it. I like the stuff that's happening on the Rossi during the hunt with Holden, you know, glowering at his screen, and then the angle up on Alex looking down over the railing, things like that. It feels like Alex is physically separated from Holden. He can't get through to Holden verbally or emotionally, mm-hmm. or anything else like that. And that's kind of neat. And then the intercutting of the flashbacks with Dr. Strickland, and then in present time when mm-hmm. the team and Prax are following Strickland's trail. That's really neat. Some of the stuff in there is sort of scripted to be obvious. You know when you know when Strickland injects May with her medicine and drops the canister, you know the immediate next scene is going to be Prax finding the canister and picking it up. It just sort of goes that way. So maybe what I'm saying that it's well directed, but the scripting, at least with Here There Be Dragons, feels kind of on the nose to me.
Here There Be Dragons was written by Georgia Lee, who's written 4 episodes of The Expanse over several seasons, as well as editing a good chunk of season 1 and 2, including both of these episodes. And The Monster and the Rocket was written by Mark Fergus and Hawk Ostby, which is a name I still can't believe. But there did seem like there is a, you know, they're both well done, but it did seem like, you know, The Monster and the Rocket, I think we've all voiced, is a really special episode. And these are two writers who have a lot of experience and have a lot of experience writing important episodes of The Expanse. So what did you guys think? Do you have anything else to say about the writing in these two episodes?
I do sort of feel like Georgia Lee knows which beats she needs to hit and is just really methodically hitting those beats in maybe something of an obvious way. Fergus and Ostby, they're the showrunners, right? I mean,
they're executive producers.
I feel like they're just sort of inherently plugged into the creative vision somehow.
I want to come back to some of the acting that we see in this episode when we talk specifically about some of these storylines. So why don't we move on to what happens in the Ganymede setting? There's a lot, obviously, that goes down in these episodes. One of the things that I thought was interesting as kind of just a throwaway scene is when Naomi drops the bomb to Prax that she had a child. She tells him, you know, he's like, you would understand, you don't have a kid. And she said, or you don't have a kid who's taken from you. And she's like, oh, wait, actually, my baby boy was taken from me and I tried to find him and failed. Which is the first time we've seen Naomi allude to this, but I don't think we've ever heard her speak so specifically about this. And I do think it's interesting she tells Prax and not maybe one of the people she's closer with. What did you guys think about this conversation?
Well, I think she both uses it later to kind of be like, when she's talking to, I think specifically Holden, about like what Prax is willing to, like, how Prax decision making is happening. She's like, he's not going to listen to certain things because right. This is his focus. I mean, I also think it is interesting in the lead up to her, you know, seeing a woman holding a baby, asking to be let on a ship. I think Naomi is seeing, you know, all of these refugees, all of these people, but certainly seeing children who would be left to die is a whole other layer, especially when you consider her as a mother. I mean, hopefully anyone, you know, you don't want these children to die.
Yeah, you don't have to have a child.
Exactly, you don't have to have a child, but knowing that adds a different layer to her character in these episodes.
Mm-hmm. And it sort of reveals, we had some hints about this coming in previous episodes. Mm-hmm. And I think that perhaps that's the deal that she made with Fred Johnson. You know, one of these days I'm going to need you to find somebody for me, or whatever that line was. So it's not coming out of the blue. But it does just sort of happen at just the right time, you know. Here's Prax. He's got a missing kid. So now is the time. And that's sort of what I meant about the script being just a little more on the nose.
Especially in The Monster and The Rocket, I think it's interesting to see Naomi's storyline interspersed with what's happening back on the Rossi, especially with Holden. We have a lot of... in some ways, it feels like Holden's obsession with finding and killing the protomolecule. That's always been, or for a very long time, that's been something that we know he wants to do. But he really takes it to the next level. And seeing him become obsessive of this to the point of, you know, not instantly going back to get Naomi or making that a priority, I think puts his obsession in, like, a really specific context. We see Naomi saving all these people while Holden's, like, become obsessed with hunting this protomolecule. Do you think that this makes sense for Holden's character at this point, that he would become so single-minded in this way?
In some ways, it does feel a little out of the blue to me how, like, not out of the blue. He really goes to, like, 200% in these episodes. However, I do think Holden likes black and white solutions and believing that the thing that is going to create good in the universe is stopping this protomolecule, man. I understand why he latches onto that. Whereas Naomi, seeing the gray of, like, I'm not going to stop these big things from happening, does feel true to their characters.
Naomi's still just coming across as way more mature than Holden. And... until the end of episode 12, you know, when he sort of has this moment of enlightenment that, you know, you can either fruitlessly try to kill this one source of the protomolecule, or you can save your family and do the right thing, you know. And he gets there, but a lot of that posturing, a lot of that trying to be bigger than he is, you know, he finally becomes bigger rather than posturing at the end when he gets the Martian Navy to blink. But before that, he's just growly and shouty. And and I'm still not sure whether it's a mode that's not Stephen Strait's forte as an actor, or if it's or if Stephen Strait's actually playing it perfectly right and this is Holden trying to be somebody he's not, you know?
Yeah. Well, he's someone who's not comfortable with leadership still. So I think that's playing into it. If, like, I don't know. Sometimes it feels like he's playing a leader rather than always being a leader. He's also so unnecessarily mean to Prax. Just like, because Prax is saying the things that he doesn't want to hear.
Plant guy, though, is just like the most devastating takedown.
Oh, yeah, I know.
I feel bad for him, and yet, damn.
I think also Holden's hunt in this episode is not helped by this speech he gives about, or like this little insight he has about during the European invasion of America, how the Native Americans couldn't see the European tall ships at first because it was so outside their understanding. And this is a show, The Expanse is a show that obviously draws from a lot of historical precedent and is thinking about historical and current colonialism as in the real world as inspiration for what's happening on this show on a much larger scale in terms of, you know, these are people who are going out into space and have gone out to space and what that looks like. But yeah, this felt like a weird speech for Holden to give as someone who grew up in like seemingly this like very progressive and or radical collective, especially in this context. Was that something that stood out to either of you?
It definitely stood out. I don't know if it stood out especially because we watched these episodes on Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day, which I suppose I should think about these things more often, but it definitely, within that context, I was just like, what? I think I just wrote, ugh, in my notes when I was just like, oh, what? No. It seems like he would have, or hopefully, this is one of those things too of like the way the future, like this is the future, but it's also being made now, right? Like I would hope that there was some more nuanced understanding of these kind of things in the future. And that felt very much like a simplistic narrative.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I just wrote an article about Kara Gies, who plays drummer, her comments at New York Comic Con about, you know, being an Indigenous woman on the show and how that influences her portrayal of a belter. She plays, and of belter politics, she plays drummer on the show. So, you know, you're just saying, like, maybe the fact that it was Indigenous People's Day made you think more intensely or maybe made you more sensitive to these issues. I'm wondering if that was also a factor for me as well. In Here There Be Dragons, we see Alex spending a lot of time by himself on the Rossi. And he's technically talking to the Rossi, I think, or a lot of the time he's talking to the Rossi. But he has – Kaz Anvar is asked to do a lot of scenes, not only in this episode, but in other episodes where he has no scene partner, basically. And I'm just – yeah, I was curious to hear what you guys thought of that, you know, pattern of that dynamic or lack thereof. I've been thinking a lot about Alex's character on this rewatch and how he is and isn't used. And I think he's one of the weaker parts of this story character-wise. And I wonder if these kinds of scenes maybe have something to do with that.
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I like what Cass Anvar is doing with it. I think he's one of my favorites in terms of charisma. Mm-hmm. He passes the I want to have a beer with him test hands down. I mean, I want to have a beer with all of them, especially Shoresh. But on camera, he's got great charisma. He's a great part of the fan community. He's the one who's pretty much responsible for the fan community being called the Screaming Firehawks because they stole his original name for the Rossi there. But you're right. It's like his charisma is lifting the part, a very badly underwritten part. On Star Trek Next Generation, you know, at least you had the computer talking back to you. Here There Be Dragons requires him to have these long and drawn out conversations with the Rossi, which fortunately has much better voice recognition than my phone. But in the end, when he finally sets down and picks up Holden and Prax, we have to justify it because he's just being sort of quirky and he's calling the Rossi a she and a we and all that sort of stuff. But there's really no reason for him to be doing that except the script requires him to, because he's got to convey information to the audience somehow. I like what he's doing. I just feel really weird about what the writers not giving him more to do.
Yeah, I don't think they give him a lot to do. And actually, now that I'm trying to think of examples of this kind of dynamic working in other shows, I think Firefly maybe did it a little bit better. And I think they did it way less, but also there was the ship itself had more character. And I don't think the Rossi actually, I don't think anyone would say the Rossi is its own character, which I think is fine. But because of that, it's really, I don't know, Alex is kind of the one who gets to construct that character for himself, at least. And the way he talks to the Rossi is, like, you know, mentioning that he calls it a she and, like, is often kind of, like, I don't know, he uses a lot of language that I associate with, like, sexism or, like, kind of patronizing, like, gendered stuff. And I don't think that's what's happening here, but I think it's language that I do associate with, what we're going to say. Can you articulate my point?
I was going to say, I've been called sweetheart enough in, like, a patronizing way.
Yeah.
That when he calls the Rossi sweetheart, it rubs me the wrong way. And I don't think that is Kaz Anvar's fault at all.
And we don't see Alex treating female characters in that way.
Yeah.
Right. So there is, like, that.
Yeah. It feels unnecessary or strange, maybe.
It does feel a little archaic. I mean, this is supposed to be 300 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't a Star Trek future where all prejudices have been erased or anything else like that. It's a very lived-in future, but objectifying the Rossi does feel a little backwards, and we never see that on any of the other ships in the show.
Yeah, it's like objectifying the Rossi for no good reason, like story-wise or character-wise. So it's just confusing. And there's not a lot on this show that confuses me in terms of, you know, what his purpose is, because I think the show is very thoughtful about most of its storytelling elements. Especially the scene involving Naomi saving all those people, which I did want to talk
you were just like,
a little
let's
bit.
Go from-
I did want to talk more about, because this is one of my favorite scenes in the entire series, and also just one of my favorite television scenes, full stop. I wrote an article about this when during the period between when The Expanse was canceled and when it was picked up by Amazon. And using it as an example of why this show is so important, I think, and the kind of nuanced storytelling it tells. And part of it, I think, is because I think of The Expanse as a show that does take itself very seriously and wants to, you know, it considers itself like very serious television. And that kind of has come to mean, I think, grittier, nihilistic, or dark in a lot of scenarios and a lot of TV shows and a lot of movies. And I think The Expanse is one of the few shows that is still very dark in a lot of ways and serious, but it has these moments of hope, and it has these moments of hope that also pay off, like a faith in humanity that I think is underrepresented right now in pop culture. And yeah, I just love this scene so much. And I remember watching it the first time with Jen and one of our friends, Justin, and after it finished, we all looked at each other and we all were just crying, which is a cool moment, actually.
This is my notes for the story were like crying. I just like, there's so many mob scenes in television or in this show, even where there's a lot of scenes earlier in the show of like rioting, people panicking, and this is idea in this moment that they can appeal to a crowd's humanity. It's not just about Naomi or that big guy's humanity. It's about, and it's connected to this idea of belter culture too, about we take care of people. We don't leave people behind, or we sacrifice for each other. Right.
Life is hard out here, and there are lots of parents with children there, and mm-hmm. the assumption being that a parent will sacrifice themselves for their child if it gives them a chance. So it's all kind of structured to make it seem plausible. It helps that big guy whose name is Ciampa, but I don't know how often he's actually mentioned by name in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it helps that he's physically imposing. So there's stuff there. There's a big metal door that cannot be breached. There's a big guy with a forceful personality there. You know, there are all kinds of things, but in the end, it's all about reason and being mm-hmm. straight up. And we are in such a post-truth era right now in 2019 United States. To see that moment again right now of that kind of knowledgeable self-sacrifice, it is certainly, to this point, the most powerful moment in The Expanse.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say one more thing about it, which is that I love the detail that it's not just women and children who they're saving, it's also men, because that just makes me think of, you know, with the Syrian refugee crisis and kind of the politics of who gets asylum in certain places and how, yeah, single men are often not given the same chances as other people. But I don't know. Yeah, it's just the value of everyone's lives and not like, I think that, you know, there's an argument made for like, you know, protecting and prioritizing children. But if this is also a future where gender equality is maybe further along, I like that idea of, you know, these lives are worth as much and they have just, I mean, or yeah, I don't know what I'm trying to articulate here, but that was a detail that I really loved about it.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, the world of The Expanse is more equal, more equitable in terms of gender, unless you're a legitimately salvaged Martian warship.
I was going to say, too, I think there's elements of their reason, right? Of like, we're Belters, this is how Belters act, that is a callback to, you know, Fred Johnson or what's Jared Harris's character's name?
Anderson Dawes.
Anderson Dawes. Like these big OPA kind of speeches that are, I feel like, are often used to manipulate. And this doesn't feel like a manipulation. It's appealing to the same idea of this is who Belters are, but in a way that asks people to choose to be their best self-sacrifice. I don't know. Like, make an amazing choice. Feels really interesting.
Yeah, are we ready to move off of Ganymede?
I don't know.
Onto Earth before Ganymede totally collapses?
That's a dark segue there.
It's a dark show sometimes. A lot happens on Earth as well this week. I found a lot of the Captain Martin's Bobby interaction really rich. We learn a little bit about Bobby's father. Apparently he knew Martins and, you know, unsurprisingly also has a military connection, which many Martians do. We get a lot of language in these episodes about the younger generation of Martians kind of being soft or not understanding true sacrifice. Did it remind anyone else of like boomer millennial tensions? Because it did remind me of that.
You had everything that was handed to you. And you know, the boomer, you know, we talk about the boomers having been spoiled after their parents, the greatest generation, you know. So and that's really it's really rich coming from Martins after we've seen just how hard and how dedicated Bobby and her team that was sacrificed for a commercial that they were, you know. Martins is the worst kind of hypocrite, and when he starts off on that, I'm like, yeah, this is the point when Bobby beats the crap out of him, isn't it? I'm going to enjoy this time rather than just be surprised.
I know he uses the language of sacrifice and collectivism and a larger goal to just justify all of these very selfish actions. It's very frustrating and also something that I think we see a lot in public life right now as well.
And he was introduced as a chaplain, remember? A chaplain.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
A chaplain.
Silly me. You'd think that a chaplain would, you know, do more than just sort of shrug at the idea of killing a whole bunch of Marines just for a tech demo.
I'm not sure if Martin's character totally actually holds up. I mean, I think he does what he has to do to further the plot and his character's continuity is sacrificed to a certain extent for other characters like Bobby. Because I also think it's incredibly strange that he gives up that information to Bobby. I mean, she is, like, beating him up. But, you know, he shows her the commercial. He gives her everything she needs. Did that surprise anyone else?
For sure.
I mean, yeah. It feels, like, a little bit too easy.
He is very proud.
Yeah. But, I mean, maybe I think the only way it works, I mean, there's two ways. One, they're just like, we need to move this plot along, which is fine, you know. But I also think he underestimates Bobby. Like, he doesn't think he's telling her this, but he's also like, and we're going to send you back to Mars in disgrace. What are you going to do? I don't think he thinks that she's going to, even though she's beating him up, I don't think he thinks that she would defect.
Right.
Yeah, to be fair, most people wouldn't, or most Martians wouldn't.
Yeah.
It shocked the hell out of me when she did it. As a viewer, that first time when she's sprinting for the gate, And a smarter person than me would have seen the border lines for Mars and the UN and would have realized what she was doing. But I didn't until she got on her knees and asked for political asylum. And I was thunderstruck.
I think it surprised Christian, too, which is saying something. She's not a woman who is easily surprised.
Yeah, it's so it's very shocking. It's such a shocking move. But in a way, even like the way Frankie Adams plays that scene, in some ways she almost looks like, wow,
I just did that.
Yeah. I did it.
Yeah. But then we get the explanation of why she did it, you know, in that exchange between her and Kotcher. When he scoffs at her for being someone who sold out her own people, and she... comes back, I've never crossed anyone first, but burn me or mine and I'll go through you like a door. That's, you know, at that point she was burned by her government and it hurts, but she's going to go through Mars like a door.
And it does lead us to getting the formation of the trio of Christian, Katya, and Bobby, which is both a political coming together, but also great comedy. Why are these three characters so much fun to watch together?
Oh, I mean, they all have this like great wry sense of humor, I think.
Yeah. It's been fun watching Kotcher and Christian spar. Mm-hmm. But you want to see them score points on each other with an audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think also there's a lot of different configurations in this trio, if that makes sense. There's things that are really similar about Katya and Bobby, where they're both these, like, you know, military, they both have this military background. And then obviously Katya and Christian are both from Earth. But then Bobby and Christian have, like, similarities as well. They're both, like, you know, no-nonsense women who... will say what they think and maybe get a lot of flack for it, but don't care. So it's cool to see all those different like dynamics within the group work. Yeah, it's fascinating and really fun to see play out on screen.
Yeah, it's not exactly a flat team structure, to borrow a phrase from another show. It's more like situationally, even though Christian outranks them all in some way or another, you know, situationally one will take charge and then another. Yeah, although I'm dipping slightly into spoiler territory there by saying that, but yeah, they've all got their skills.
Yeah, they have their skills and they're very competent in their own ways, but they're also aware of the things they're not good at. And that's a really cool character trait, both in a story, and I think I like that in people in real life too.
Yeah. Christian's relative frailty as they're getting ready to take off. You know, she is not happy.
Yeah.
So, in addition to this trio, we also get, I guess, like the trifecta of these political and/or like powerful figures in Christian, Erin Wright, and Mao. You know, coming together in some way to have a conversation. Yeah, which we've seen them together before in, like, casual conversation. But this is the first time we've seen them really with, like, most of their cards on the table or more of their cards on the table. Yeah, what did you all think about this showdown?
Oh, Erin Wright.
I mean, I still don't entirely know, and I don't think we're meant to know, at what if he was scheming all along. I tend to doubt it. Not that I think he was ever getting to the the suicide place that the show was trying to head fake us into.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave himself up to Avasarala because he didn't have anywhere else to go. He was going to get found out, so he was in a weaker position. He's not thrilled when Christian says that, you know, he's got to give himself up, that she's not going to protect him. So that sticks in his craw, but he's just got to do the best that he can for himself. And then she hands him this gift without realizing it, that she's going to be meeting with Mal. And he's like, wait, I know what to do now. And then he,
yeah.
And then I hate him.
Yeah, I think him giving himself up in some way to Christian is less of a surrender and more of a tactical move. I think you can see in hindsight. It's a way of him gathering information, like, will she back me up, which she never promises to do. You know, are there, would she become my ally? Are there ways that I could maybe corrupt her? And the answer to those questions is also no. But I do wonder if seeing him deliver that message to Christian is the closest to seeing his true feelings we've ever come. When he's talking about how, you know, he feels betrayed by her, it seems like that's coming from a genuine place. And, you know, he feels like he has nothing left to lose. This is his chance to tell her what he really thinks about her, because he, you know, assumes that she'll be dying soon. Yeah. And you see how much Christian, I think, actually means to him, and also how much the fact that she wasn't on his side for this hurts him, which is ridiculous, obviously, but I thought it was a cool character moment.
Yeah, he's not exactly a cold villain. He's emotional. I think he was a little genuinely shaken by killing the Russian defense minister, and then he very quickly switches into forcing himself to hyperventilate a bit and get panicky. But he's not exactly holding his cool in that message to Mal at all. He's pissed.
Yeah, you get the sense, or I did, that, you know, as much of a manipulator as Aaron Wright is, like, political assassination is not something, he's not used to getting his hands dirty in that way. And I do think he is shaken by that, even if he really goes through with his plan very coldly as he's doing it, until he sees, you know, this guy's dead. And that he does look shaken at that point.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why Aaron Wright is such a good antagonist and or villain is that, you know, we talk a lot about Amos and what he is able to feel for other people and his ability to know, you know, right from wrong, or to forge his own moral compass. And I never really get the sense that Aaron Wright doesn't know right from wrong in some... you know, those are vague terms, but I think he has empathy for this, the Martian minister. I think he feels things when he murders him in cold blood, and he still chooses to do it. And that's what makes him so frightening and so terrible.
He knows what he's doing, but he's all about making Earth great again. And and there we go. But look at where we are, and look at where we started. Episode one, Christian is torturing a belter, and Aaron Wright is admonishing her for having violated some conventions.
I think that...
Look at
that introduction goes a long way to, like, still making us believe that there's a chance that Aaron Wright might choose a different path.
Yeah.
So in addition to these two storylines, there's also things happening on the Arbogast. Do we care?
No.
Okay, that was fast. Well, but there's something going on down there. We got a couple of minutes of bizarre blue hellscape video. Wasn't that worth something?
Maybe this is worth more when you don't already know where it's going. I don't know. I can't remember. When there's a bit more mystery to it.
They did spend a fair bit of time on that, didn't they?
Yeah. There's a lot about, like, if we just take the probe apart and put a different probe together. And you're like, well...
Yeah. Let's get back to Holden, you know?
Yeah.
You're just so emotionally invested in what's happening in the other storylines that it's hard to care about what's happening here, even though objectively you understand why it's very important.
Yeah.
And I think that does go back to not having a character in the storyline that we know and or care about.
For sure. For sure. There's mm-hmm. just the person that the old flame of Christians and the colonel that we saw in a couple of episodes. And that's just it, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. We are now entering the spoiler zone. For those who have not watched past episode 12 of season 2 and do not wish to be spoiled for the rest of season 2 and season 3, it's time to slingshot your way out of here. We hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of the season 2 finale, Caliban's War, and the season 3 premiere, Fight or Flight. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found and follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. For everyone else, let's dive in. So we haven't actually talked about May yet. I remember watching it the first time, and I remember how much tension is created by the fact that we don't know if May is still alive, and we don't know if May is, you know, as Prax worries, if May is the hybrid that Holden is hunting.
Or is now hunting Holden.
Yeah, I know. That's the other thing about Holden's hunt. You're like, even in terms of like, is this the best use of your time? Could it also be your death? Yes. But yeah, what did you think about the May stuff? And what was it like watching this, knowing that she's still alive out there and kicking?
So much of this storyline felt a lot more like the part in like whatever zombie movies or something where someone's still trying to save their loved one and you're just like, even if it is May, man, like,
gotta let go, she's a zombie.
Yeah, like, and I think I had more complicated feelings when I thought it was maybe May, which doesn't make sense because no matter what, this is a child or mm-hmm. was a child. But you would think, knowing like seeing like Katoa as a kind of character you get to know as a become a protomolecule man, you're kind of like, but I'm just like, I think knowing how scary the protomolecule man is in the next few episodes, I'm like, no, don't try to help it or stop, kill it. Even though I don't agree with Golden's single-mindedness, I'm like, oh no, don't try to save that.
Yeah, in this scenario, you don't have a lot of options.
No.
You don't have a lot of good options.
No.
I also thought a lot about friend of the podcast, Tom, of the Moment podcast, mm-hmm. and his inability to watch things in which children are in danger and not knowing if they're going to be okay.
Right.
Which, some of these kids aren't going to be okay, Tom.
No. Sorry, Tom. yeah.
And we do see a lot of this second episode is about Holden coming to grips with the idea that he can't control the protomolecule, that its spread is probably inevitable, or at least if someone is able to stop it, it's not going to be him. Which is good considering where we wind up by the end of season 3. It feels so far from here that things escalate this quickly. But by the end of season 3, there's the Ring Network, which gives access to all these other worlds that we're going to get to explore in season 4. And we see Holden talking to protomolecule investigator Nott Miller.
Yeah.
yeah, knowing that's where the protomolecule evolution is going, how does that affect this viewing of the protomolecule at this point in its evolution?
You know, it makes it kind of funny how single-minded and simplistic Holden turns out to be in his thinking about what the protomolecule is and what it represents. You know, it is just this thing that is going to kill and dismember people or things like that. And because his eyes are almost literally going to be open, he's actually going to be communing with the damn thing with the help mm-hmm. of the thing that is not Miller. So it's actually kind of a neat character arc for Holden over the course of 3 years that he goes from Captain Ahab to Captain Picard.
Oh, that's good, Chip.
Oh,
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're getting closer to, very close, in fact, to Naomi's decision to give the protomolecule sample to Fred Johnson, which is not teased at all, like, in these episodes. How are you guys thinking about that potential? I guess I feel so empathetic and on Naomi's side in this that I don't even want to call it a betrayal. But I think maybe that is an unpopular opinion.
I wasn't thinking about it a ton watching these episodes. I think maybe because it's less of a point that... But there is that moment when she is like, I'm staying behind. These are the reasons I'm staying behind. And Holden doesn't try to talk her out of it. He doesn't, like, he just, it's like, all right, they kiss and then they move on. And so it is interesting seeing, you know, he views it as the Fred Johnson protomolecule thing as betrayal. But, like, at any point, like, seeing him be able to accept her taking different paths, it's very interesting to think was there a point where if she had revealed this, would he have been a little bit more accepting?
Right. He almost got mm-hmm. there, and then she betrays him, and then the logic of it just sort of escapes him because, well, she lied to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is not really her MO. She does withhold a lot of information.
Exactly.
And that is a fine line between omission of facts and lying.
Yeah.
Even with something like her, you know, again, revealing the fact that she has a child out there somewhere, it feels like the stakes are a lot lower for her emotionally telling Prax, who's someone she doesn't actually know that well and, you know, I think she senses won't be around for very long. I mean, who knows who's going to die and how quickly any of them are going to be or how long any of them will be around for. But yeah, I think that is an interesting choice in that respect as well, that it's someone that isn't, you know, one of her family members.
This just makes me think about how I wish Prax ended up being a longer term member of the Rossi crew.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a chance that we'll see him in season 4? I haven't heard a word.
I always hope so.
I haven't heard anything about that either. But I do, in the first episode he's in, one of my notes was, I miss Prax. That's all it said. Another thing I think we all miss is the Cotillard Avasarala Bobby dynamic, which doesn't stick around as long as it could have, maybe.
No.
All good things must end, I suppose.
No, it doesn't. I mean, we said before, you know, the great chemistry, the way they all trade off in different roles and things like that. But not only do they go their separate ways when they have to leave Kotcher behind, but eventually, you know, Bobby and Avasarala, their paths diverge too. So it's like we've just had this perfect little triad here for about 3 episodes, and then we lose that, and darn it, you've given us a formula, Expanse. I don't care how well crafted your little plots are and how good your books are, just give me what I want. Give me the spinoff show with these 3 people.
I just want to watch Bobby eat cucumber sandwiches while Avasarala eviscerates people.
That was delightful.
It's so good.
Yeah, in particular those two, because I understand, you know, Kotcher obviously dies. And, you know, asking for 3 characters to stay together is maybe too much, but having some sort of connection between Avasarala and Bobby, I think, would be interesting. Maybe it doesn't make any sense. And I think part of this is informed by the fact that it seems like in real life, the Shura is, and Frankie have this, like, really sweet, like, mentor-mentee relationship. Or I've seen, like, I've interviewed them before at Comic-Con, and they're often paired together. And it's really nice to see them interact. And yeah, it's just, I think that translates into their relationship on screen, and I'd like to see more of them together, which hopefully will happen potentially in season 4, but maybe even further down the line. Don't tell us, book readers. Or tell us. I don't know. I don't want to know, but maybe Jen and Chip do.
If I really wanted to know, I would read the books.
Same. I am still caught in this why am I not reading the books kind of place. But the pacing of watching it with the show is just sticking with me.
Yeah, I'm still fine not reading the books, but we'll see how I feel after season four drops all at the same time. And I have, you know, the wait from season four to season five. Although I made it through this hiatus, so maybe it's never going to happen. Does anyone have anything else to add on these episodes?
Oh, they're really, really good, and I am not sure how it's going to be. The next episode of the podcast, get this, we're doing a season finale and a season premiere simultaneously.
I know.
I was thinking about that, too. I don't know how... I think it's going to go great. I'm excited. We're going to have a lot to talk about, I think.
It might have to be a long episode, or we're just going to have to really...
I'm sure nothing will happen in these episodes.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
Thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss the season 2 finale, Caliban's War, and the season 3 premiere, Fight or Flight. Until then, we have to do good where we can, when we can.